You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey, this is Ken Corsini with the Deal Farm. On today's Best Deal Ever episode, I'm with Tucker Merrihew. Tucker, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing, Ken? Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Man, thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure, as always.
So Tucker is the host of the Real Deals podcast, and he's also the owner of TTM Development Company out of Portland, Oregon. And we were just talking. It's interesting. His business is somewhat similar to mine, and he does a little bit of everything. He's doing some wholesale deals. He's doing a few fix and flips. But really, it sounds like his business is transitioning to more of a new construction company. But Tucker, I'd love to maybe go back to the beginning. Tell us how you got started in real estate.
Yeah, for sure. I guess it started when I was finishing up. I went to University of Colorado, played lacrosse there. As everybody finishes up college, you got to figure out what the hell we're going to do when we get done with college, right?
And, sure.
Lacrosse wasn't exactly like hoops or football. It didn't have a high-paying end game. So I had to figure out an alternative approach to my adult life. And so I ended up getting a job as a loan officer, and I moved back to Portland. I actually found an ad in the newspaper that said they'd train you and they'd give you a job, no experience necessary, which sounded great because I didn't really have any experience in real estate or lending or anything like that. Well, it turns out, you know, it was a good thing I answered the ad and I went there. But have you ever seen the movie Boiler Room?
No.
With Ben Affleck and...
Yes, I know the movie. But I don't think I've seen it.
It's like that classic scene where he walks in and he's like, throws his, Ferrari keys on the table, and he tells everybody how cool he is and how much money he makes. And it was like this big recruiting room of people, and they try and see who sticks. Well, that was kind of what this mortgage company was.
Nice.
It was a little more colorful than that. But bottom line is they gave me my start in the business. I stayed there for about a year. I then moved on to help another coworker who worked with me there to start his own company, just because we kind of didn't like the direction of where things were going and the quality of people that were around us there. And so I helped him build his company up. I was his top producing loan officer. And then after about a year and a half, 2 years there, I actually started my own mortgage company. And so wow. I ran that for a number of years. And then in, I forget the date, but it was August 2007. That's when the music stopped. We got calls from every major bank basically saying they were freezing our pipelines. They'd no longer be able to honor their loan commitments. That was the day that kind of the wheels fell off of the real estate business. And so at that point, up to that point, I was kind of straddling the fence. I was doing loans, I was owning a mortgage company, and I was trying to do some investment stuff on the side. I bought a house for myself during that time period that I renovated lightly, finished the basement, moved my buddies in. It was like a big party pad, got rent, paid the mortgage. Ended up selling that at the peak right before the real estate crash, the wheels fell off the mortgage industry, and I made about 180 grand.
Wow.
That was, a lot of luck. But also it was just a great location where I bought the property, but that was kind of my seed money to kind of get me to stop straddling the fence and jump in, with both feet on the investment side of the business. So when the wheels fell off the mortgage company or the mortgage business, I decided to basically lay off all the loan officers, lay off my processor, which was hard because it was my best friend's girlfriend at the time. So that created a little bit of issue, but
oh, man.
Bottom line is it's what I had to do. And so at that point I kind of redirected the ship. And I opened what is now TTM Development Company. We started buying a lot of REOs, a lot of short sales, things like that, because that was kind of the low-hanging fruit back then. And, back in 2008, 2009, there was not many of us that stuck around in the real estate business, and there were very few of us that were actually buying and renovating and putting stuff back on the market. And so that's what we started doing back then. And gradually over time, we did a ton of your kind of entry-level ranch-style rehab homes. Eventually we started moving up market and, we started doing higher price point stuff or mid price point and then up to higher price point stuff. We started doing larger remodels, add-ons, second stories, things like that. Even jacking up houses, making the basement ceilings tall, all kinds of crazy stuff. And then, from there, we eventually got into new construction kind of by accident. And, the rest is kind of history. We've been doing mainly new construction ever since. But the whole root of my business is generated around our you know, bringing leads in of people that potentially want to sell their property, and that's done by direct mail. That's 99% of our business comes from direct mail. And so now the business just, we do our marketing, the leads come in, we cherry pick the stuff that we want to keep and build the new construction on. Occasionally we keep a rehab or two, and then everything else we wholesale off to you know, some of the people that we've made good relationships with over the years here in Portland.
Interesting. So, you know, going back to when you got into buying short sales and REO, it was interesting because I was doing the same thing, and it was funny because everybody's sort of falling out of the business, and that was when the best deals were just falling in your lap. It was crazy. I mean, you could just pick them off the MLS. So were you buying most of those REOs and the short sales directly off your MLS?
Yeah, I was. You know, I did what a lot of people did. I tried to butter up with, you know, some of the REO agents in town. And,
yep.
You know, so I got a lot of stuff directly from them, but we could also just put in offers on stuff. And so I had a guy that just offered on a lot of things. And I mean, I remember one house in 2009 we got that we picked up for $102,000. And it was just like the most ridiculous deal ever. And I remember I couldn't find anybody to actually wholesale it to. Nobody wanted to buy it. And so I actually ended up renovating it. And we made like, I don't know, $60,000 or something flipping that little ranch house. But that's how bad the market was. There was none of us out there, or there was very few, you know.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, but, you know, mainly just REOs at that point. We kind of hooked up with a little outfit that was doing a lot of short sale negotiations. So we'd buy a lot of those from them once they'd get them negotiated. Most of the time they were making a little margin on us. You know, they were flipping them. It was before the deed restrictions and all that crazy stuff went into play. So it was kind of more the wild, wild west as far as them being able to make money. But mainly REOs and short sales for a while there.
And were you wholesaling or fixing and flipping?
Just fixing and flipping at that point.
Okay.
Occasional wholesale here and there. Eventually, we started going down to the auction, and we were buying at the auction a little bit too, and we did wholesale some of those. You know, I did wholesale a few REOs. It's a little more difficult to wholesale REOs back then because, you know, you got to get it at enough of a discount off list price for people to feel like giving them value to be able to wholesale it to them.
Yeah.
So we ended up rehabbing the majority of the REOs that we bought because of that.
There's nothing worse than a wholesaler bringing you like an REO deal and they're asking more than what it's listed for. It's like, dude,
you know,
what are you doing?
That used to drive me bananas. You listed at 135. It's been on the market for 6 months. They've reduced it from 175. And they want to sell it to you for 147.
They're like, man, I could have got the deal. What are you bringing me? Like,
where's the value, man? I mean, come on.
Yeah. So, you know, so same thing here. So in Georgia, we're doing the same thing. We're buying up REOs and short sales. It was easy pickings. And then for us, it was probably 2012 that we sort of saw the writing on the wall that it was drying up. What about you guys in Portland? When did you see the REO, you know, the MLS dry up for you?
You know, probably about that same time, but we actually jumped ship from the REOs in about 2010.
Okay.
Late 2010. I kind of saw the writing on the wall, which is that, you know, this whole foreclosure epidemic was going to end. And so we, at that point, decided to stop putting the majority of our efforts into REOs and bidding down at the auction. We stopped going down to the auction, too, because some of the bigger bidding services made their way into Portland.
I'm
sure you're familiar with that. Yeah. Basically allows anybody and everybody to bid while not being there necessarily.
Oh, yeah.
So it went from being a handful of the, you know, usual suspects down there to the handful plus the bidding service.
Yeah.
That changed the entire dynamic of the game down there. So we changed the heading of the ship again in about 2010, and we dove almost exclusively into direct mail. We do a lot of online stuff too, but most of our efforts were focused on direct mail. And just really learning the direct mail game, learning how to, you know, really master it in terms of using it for lead production for real estate investing.
Yeah, which is interesting. There's a lot of folks like us that have had to delve into, you know, direct mail, and we're not necessarily late to the dance, but guys like you are sort of a couple years ahead of guys like me in terms of mastering direct mail. And we're actually getting pretty good at it now, but I'm curious. I'd love to talk a little bit about how you do your direct mail campaign. Who are you mailing to? What are your lists? And maybe even how you're organized internally to how to handle those leads.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I guess first and foremost, I don't like to mail lists that other people are mailing constantly. So, for example, the absentee list. Yes, there's some absentees that we do buy, but I just despise mailing a straight absentee list. It hurts every bit of my being. And, you know, back in the day, 2011, 2012, even 2013, you could get away with blasting that list and do pretty well. But, you know, lists like that are kind of the first list that every real estate investor runs into. And right now, if people want to generate deals and actually make any real money in this business, they got to get good at going direct to seller. So everybody's kind of making their way to direct mail. Whether they stay there and stick is a whole other topic.
Yep.
They're starting there. So there's a whole lot of noise in the mailbox of people that are just straight absentee owners.
Yep.
So bottom line is that we try and create lists or get a hold of lists that are much harder to find. The barrier of entry is higher. And so that seems to slim out the majority of our competition because most real estate investors are incredibly lazy. So if it's difficult to get a hold of or to create, they're not going to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, I've talked to guys that have taken an absentee list and then scrubbed it down against, you know, maybe a code violation or tax delinquent or whatever, and they've gotten a much smaller list, but a really highly concentrated responsive list too.
Right. And I think that's fantastic because now you've got multiple layers of potential motivation.
Yep.
But on top of that, you've cut out all the fat, right? So now you, as that person, can justify spending more money and making a more quality, more memorable direct mail piece.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, make more money.
So that's a good. So that's a good question. What are you mailing right now? Are you doing postcards? Are you doing yellow letters?
We haven't done yellow letters since about 2012.
Okay.
Just because, again, that's the thing everybody sends.
Yeah, sure, right.
So we try and make a point to mail things that are different than our competition in a variety of ways. I won't talk about exactly what it is we send, but I'll kind of allude to the fact that we do use handwritten stuff, and we mainly greeting card type things.
Yep.
The packaging is important. What's included in the letter is important. So we do everything at every point where you can make an impression and be memorable to them. We really play up that on everything.
Interesting.
And so, we also come from a branded perspective. I know a lot of people don't necessarily have a brand.
Yeah.
And they feel like you can be the local Joe Schmo home buyer and that's what people want to see. I think back in the day, maybe that was true. I think our business has grown up a lot in the last 5 years. And if you look at where the business was direct mail wise prior to the bust, it's like night and day different. So I think this industry has grown up. I think a lot of sellers, they recognize that this is more of an industry now. And so if you can get in front of them in a way that is professional and gives them the least amount of skepticism as possible,
mm-hmm.
gives you the highest likelihood for them to pick up the phone and call you, and from there, you know, put together a deal.
It's interesting because it's funny. I've heard both sides of the coin. You know, the anonymity of just Joe Blow versus having a really well branded, like you said, mail piece. And you know, the people that do either one claim that they've got the best. Who knows? How many times are you hitting them? So if you're starting with maybe a really nice, slick, professional mail piece, are you going back to that list multiple times? I'm assuming.
Yeah, we'll mail them. We've got like a 4-letter cycle.
Okay.
And so, depending on whether or not we really want to annoy them enough to pick up the phone quickly, we'll mail them within the first part of that cycle, much closer. So maybe 10 days apart, 2 weeks apart.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We'll gradually space it out from there. And then we'll move on to the next area, the next list, and then we'll circle back and we'll put them back in the cycle again. So
I gotcha.
It's basically a 4-letter cycle.
Yep. And every letter looks probably a little bit different, presented a little bit different,
plays up on the old one a little bit. Gets them to, hey, remember us kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Yep. That's really cool. And then do you have, this is what I've learned is just critical is follow up. Do you have a good internal system for following up with people that you've spoken to and staying in front of them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really the key to direct mail because, occasionally, I'm sure it happens to you occasionally too. You get somebody that calls up and says, hey, buy my house at 60 cents on the dollar, right?
Yep.
Rarely, but it does happen. 95% of the deals we get from direct mail, and you're probably the same way, is lead comes in, you talk to them. For whatever reason, you don't have a deal yet. Maybe you need to build more rapport. Maybe you need to continue the conversation. Maybe you need to talk to their wife. Maybe you need to talk to the other people involved in the estate, whatever it is. And you continue that conversation, continue it, build the rapport, present the offer, follow up, and then boom, then you get your acquisition.
Yep.
So there's a lot of work that goes into direct mail. Now it's worth it, well worth it, but that work is something that a lot of people aren't wanting to do, and that's part of following up.
Yep. Yep. So let's talk about your team. How are you structured internally to handle the leads?
Sure. So as far as the office is set up, I basically look at it as I've got two, almost two companies. We've got the office guys and we've got the field guys.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the office and the lead generation and the lead follow-up and putting acquisitions together, Chris, he's my office manager, has been for, you know, going on 4 or 5 years now. He's also our listing agent. So he lists all of our projects once they're completed, but he handles the phones and all the incoming leads, you know, gets the information, builds a rapport. We then go over the leads together. If it's a deal that that I'm excited about and I think is going to be a good deal, I actually go on the appointments with him. I still like to go out and meet people and talk to them and help size up the property and see what we're working with. So we usually go out together and we kind of build a rapport, check out the property. And then from there, he usually takes it from that point to presenting the offer, getting it signed, all that stuff, all the way through closing.
So does the postcard or the mail piece lead them to call your office, or does it go to like a voicemail of some sort?
Yeah, so it calls the office. And then in terms of getting those pieces out, we have 2 full-time letter writers that work for me in the office here. And so their job every day is to do our handwritten pieces and then also do the addressing, stuffing, stamping, all that stuff.
Holy cow. So you're actually doing, you're really doing handwritten. Cause somebody says handwritten, it just looks handwritten and it's.
Yeah, no, we printed. Really do it. You know, I know there's some services and some handwritten font and things like that, but having them in house cost wise, it's fairly similar. But it also allows us to really control the mail pieces, control the lists, and we can kind of pivot, you know, on a daily basis.
Wow, that's interesting.
So, yeah, and so it gives me a lot of control, and I like that, and it's been really successful for us.
So what, I'm just curious, do you pay them like by the mail piece or by the hour?
No, I pay them by the hour. I pay them all $10 an hour.
Okay, and they just literally sit in there and handwrite letters and, yep. and envelopes. So they do the letters and the envelopes.
Letters and the envelopes, and then they do the stuffing and sealing and all that stuff too.
Oh my gosh, I think you're the first person I've talked to that's doing that in-house. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of real estate investors don't have a big office, right? So if you don't have an office and you work from home, it's hard to do that.
But sure.
I do have an office. We've got a number of people that work here. It just makes sense, you know, so we've done it that way for the last, you know, going on 5 years.
And so cost-wise, do you find that it still comes out about the same as if you pay like a printing company to do it?
Yeah, it's similar, but again, we have very specialty marketing pieces.
Yeah.
So it's hard to recreate that with a printing company.
Yeah.
So, though it may cost me a little more, you know, at the end of the year, we're still making a ton of money. So, you know, for me, it just makes sense.
That's interesting. That's very cool. And so you've got one guy answering the phone, and then the two of you will actually check it out, kind of scope it out. And then your guy, Chris, will then follow up with actually getting a contract in their hands and trying to close a deal.
Yeah, he's basically in charge of all follow up. We have what we call our wall of deals.
Yep.
So, you know, the lead comes in, we have a lead sheet that we fill out, and we'll put anything that is in follow-up mode or, you know, whether it be next month, next year, whatever, we put it on our wall of deals, and we have, you know, it's sectioned off to, you know, ooh, that's hot, or, you know, first date, or whatever. He's got a bunch of funny sayings for it. Get the idea, so that we know what stuff is in the process, and so we've got that wall of deals, and he just kind of works that every day, along with all the new incoming leads that we have. That come in the funnel.
Okay, and very interesting. Okay, so in the last so many years, I'm sure you've come across just a ton of good deals. Is there one that stands out to you as maybe you would consider your best deal ever?
Yeah, you know, we've got a number of really, really big profit deals that we actually closed this last month. A few of them that were between $200,000 and $300,000 a pop, but. I would say,
nice, jeez.
Which is great, and that sounds cool to talk about, right? But I think we got to go back to what got us there as my best deal ever. And that would be a deal that actually got us into the new construction game. And it was a lead that we got from direct mail. And it came in, it was three brothers who inherited a house that their parents lived in. Parents passed away, they had to deal with the estate. So we met the brothers, built the rapport, bought the house. We thought we'd be able to rehab it. It was a pretty, it wasn't like a low-end house. It was right on the edge of a really high-end area, but it was kind of across a major thoroughfare. So anytime you know, you have these higher-end areas and you cross a major thoroughfare, sometimes those values drop off quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was right on the edge. And so they kind of wanted value based on, you know, that higher-end area factor in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we made it work. You know, we thought it would be a good project for us. We'd still make a lot of money or enough money to make it worth doing. But when we got into the project, it had some pretty major foundation issues, major horizontal cracks. And so if you know anything about foundation issues, horizontal cracks, that's when you got to start to
dig
deeper on what's going on. If they're vertical and less than a quarter inch, they're usually just small settling cracks. And so this had some big horizontal cracks. And the house, you felt like you had a little bit of vertigo walking in sections of it. If you looked at the house, it was kind of a longer house with the door in the middle, and the left and the right side were sinking a little bit, so it almost looked like a rainbow. And the reason being is on the right side of the house, the neighbor actually had a sewer line that ran under the house, never got an easement for it. It happened way back in the day. And over time, that sewer line, it was made out of the old clay pipe that eroded.
It's like a terracotta or something.
Terracotta pipe.
Yeah.
So it was draining out. It was never even making it to the sewer. And so it caused a ton of erosion in the house, which basically caused the right side to start sinking. The left side had what they call blue clay here in Portland, which is basically clay that doesn't compact well. And so it caused the house to just keep kind of settling and settling and settling. So the only way to deal with that would have been to put, first get the guy to, hook up the sewer in front of his house and abandon the old line that was running under the house. But on top of that, we would have had to put a whole bunch of piers in the ground to basically stabilize the foundation and then be able to jack it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And that was about 2010, and back then, the market wasn't very hot. And so we didn't want to have to sell a house with a bunch of piers in the ground. We thought that would be a real big uphill battle. And so at that point, we decided, it was a big decision to, as we were, basically full bore ahead as a rehab into this thing, we had it gutted and everything else, we decided to scrape it and build new construction. And so I took a pretty big risk. We built a plan that we'd never built before, so I didn't know exactly how much money it was going to cost to build it. So that was a kind of a big X factor. It was our first new construction project, so I didn't have any real history as far as myself knowing approximately what we were looking at.
Were you the contractor on the, are you licensed?
Yeah, so I've got my own construction contractor's license.
Okay.
It's the license we use in the business.
Gotcha.
But, you can be a contractor and not know anything about doing new construction.
Well, trust me, I know all about that.
Yeah. So at the time, I didn't really know that much, but we found a plan that worked. In hindsight, we would have done some pretty major tweaks on the plan because I look at it now and I kind of like, we could have done a lot better. But, it got us going. So anyway, we built the house. We ended up selling it, I think, for just under $600,000. We ended up making, I think, somewhere around $90,000 when all the dust settled.
Wow.
Which was great because we didn't know, there was that, we were, like I told you in our before the interview here, we were the first guys to build infill new construction in that pocket. And so with that house, we set the new high water mark as far as values for the area.
Yeah.
And so that was a little nerve-wracking because we didn't know, A, if people were going to pay it, but B, if we could get it to appraise. And so we managed to get both of those things to work out, and that was our first dive into new construction. And ever since then, we've just been doing more and more and more of it.
Talk about turning lemons into lemonade, man. You have a crappy foundation. You're stuck with this house. And you're like, let's just scrape it and build a new one, and you still made $90,000 on it.
Yeah, but a lot of that was luck. So, but either way, it worked out, and I'm glad that it did. It was a real pivotal point in my business because at that point, we started diving into infill new construction, and as you're aware, and a lot of your listeners probably are, it's a very, very profitable niche in this business. Has been for a while now, and it'll continue to be. And so we've kind of now bridged the gap between the builder world and the real estate investor world, and so we've become this hybrid company, which honestly, I think that's kind of the wave of the future as far as the most profitable, most successful real estate investing companies are going to be those hybrid type companies that understand how to generate quality leads for your acquisition, but then also know how to build that infill nicer product.
You are spot on, man, because I mean, that's the same thing we're doing in Atlanta. And some of our highest profit deals have been houses that we scraped or we happen to get like a really good lot off of direct mail. Because your average builder has no clue about direct mail. He does not know how to, all he knows how to do is go into a spec community and, do takedowns and compete with every other big box builder out there. But very few builders know how to find infill lots to build on.
Yeah. I mean, they really don't. And so it's a huge, and that opened my eyes then to wholesaling to builders too, right? So for example, we've got a lot right now. It's a tear down house in a hot area of Southeast Portland. We could build it, but we can make $70,000 just flipping it. So, I decided yesterday to make a couple calls, or Chris made a couple calls, and we got the guy. We just had the guy agree to price right before we jumped on here. I'm sending over the contract right now.
Man, so that's perfect.
Yeah, but that's part of getting into the builder community too, because it's kind of like there's a big divide between builders and real estate investors.
Sure.
And we've kind of created the bridge for our market, and we've got a foot in both communities, and it's been really good.
Man, that's a killer niche to be in. Are you guys scraping most of your houses, or are you finding lots?
Scraping almost exclusively. Lots, you know, they're like, you know, builders, everybody, builders going after those.
Yeah.
More obvious. The scrapers are what we as real estate investors get good at finding. So.
And most of those are coming off your direct mail pieces.
Yeah, but yeah. We're very, very targeted. A lot of our direct mail, I didn't mention this before, but we do a lot of driving for dollars.
Oh, okay, yeah.
We generate our lists for the most part because we know exactly what we're looking for as far as type of house, type of lot. And so, you know, we like it to be the most, you know, accurate, defined, quality prospect that we can get. And so that's the best way for us to do that.
Interesting. Man, you've put together quite a business model, man. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
So tell our listeners where they can find you. You've got a podcast out there. You've got a development company. If we wanted to steer somebody to your website, where would they go?
You know, I think the first place would be go to therealdealspodcast.com. You can also search it on iTunes. We're about 74 episodes deep now, so we've been doing it for about a year and a half. It's a lot of work, but it's been a lot of fun, too. I've been able to connect with a lot of people, including yourself, doing the show. And so they can go there and check me out. If they want to see my actual Sticks and Bricks real estate company, they can go to ttmdevelopmentcompany.com, and we've got a lot of our work up there, a lot of our nice houses and a lot of the stuff we've done in the past, too. So you can check us out those two places and see what you think.
Awesome. Again, that's realdealspodcast.com. And the deal's got a Z on it, right?
Yeah, it's Real Deals with a Z.
Real Deals with a Z. We'll put it on the show notes as well. And then ttmdevelopmentcompany.com. Tucker, man, I appreciate it. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, Deal Farm Podcast listeners, this is Ken Corsini with a special offer. If you go to our website right now, dealfarm.net, you have the ability to download our new blueprint. It's called 30 Days to 10K. It's basically the exact blueprint you need to start profiting from wholesaling real estate right now. It's the resources, it's the websites, it's the services that we use. I've even included my exact postcard that I send out. Basically everything you need to start getting deals in the next 30 days. Again, it's at our website, dealfarm.net. Check it out, you can download it for free. Also, we still have our free t-shirt offer. If you want a free Deal Farm Podcast t-shirt, just subscribe through iTunes to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating, and then go through our website, contact us, give us your name, address, and t-shirt size, and we will send you a t-shirt in the mail immediately. As always, thanks so much for listening to The Deal Farm. We'll see you on the next episode. Take care.